A couple of degrees of difficulty may have been added to your grocery shopping experience by the COVID-19 pandemic, but by and large, our part of obtaining groceries is relatively easy. Find the spot on the store shelf where your product lies and put it in your basket. Many people and machines get involved, though, just to get that product to the shelf. Benjamin Lohr takes us along the grocery supply chain in his book, The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. This is Benjamin Lohr's second book. His last, Hellbent, was about him taking up yoga and then launching into an exploration of devotion, obsession, and misconduct in the American yoga community. Benjamin Lohr, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
It's a pleasure.
Great to be here.
Yeah, so why groceries? What launched you into this project?
Oh, God. Well, in one respect, there's a very linear connection between the two books. My last book was on the Bikram yoga world, and I was at a Bikram yoga training to get close to Bikram Chowdhury, the guru there, and I watched all these yogis get delivered by bus from the training site to a Trader Joe's, and they kind of dismounted the bus and ran into this Trader Joe's with maniacal glee in their eyes that I had never seen before. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is really analogous to kind of this culty, obsessive yoga world that I'm immersed in, only it's the cult of food. And it had this resonance with the way food has changed over my life. But I'm like a totally separate track. Like, I've always just loved grocery stores. I like walking in them, and they have this very overpowering sensation that's almost hallucinogenic in the saturated colors that are popping out at you, and this feeling of both calm, you know, you're walking down those aisles and it's soothing, but at the same time there's just like immense power radiating from those shelves and just all the work that has gone into it. So I always want to stress the surface.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff that goes into getting those things under the shelves, as you point out of the book. But, I mean, so how far and wide did you range to cover the journeys of our groceries?
Yeah. I am a writer who wants to get as close to subject matter as possible. So for Bikram, that was like doing a lot of Bikram yoga. And for this book, I really threw myself into that world. I ended up working at a Whole Foods retail fish counter. So I get the retail side, but I ended up, you know, to check on the system of certifications. I found an activist group that allowed me to break into a factory farm with them so I could see that with my own eyes. I traveled to Thailand and Burma to meet migrant workers who are really at the bottom of the seafood supply chain. I traveled cross country with a trucker in her cab to look at the system of logistics. I tracked down Trader Joe, the guy who founded Trader Joe's and kind of set the chain that started me off on this, to learn how he founded the chain.
Now, Joe,
about getting close.
Yeah, now Joe Colombe actually died not long after you interviewed him, I gather.
Yeah, well, I interviewed him several times, but at the last he passed away sadly right before COVID in February of this year. Mm-hmm. It's just the tragedy, because he was quite the visionary who could look at the way the world was turning, and I really wonder what he would have thought of how the world was turning now and what it meant for groceries.
Oh, yeah, that would have been great to get his take on that. So, but your take on things now. So what would you say, Benjamin, is the first thing that you now understand about our food system that the rest of us shoppers don't?
That's a great question. I think it's enormity. You know, we know this in the back of our mind, but so supermarket groceries predicated on the idea of continuously available abundance, right? It's not merely that you have all these options, right? In a big grocery store these days will have 100,000 different units. But it's that all those different choices, all those pile of apples are always there. The supermarket managers are phobic of the idea of a stock out or the shelves being empty for just a second. It goes against the entire notion of what the supermarket is. And I don't think I appreciated that before the book. And then when you start to unpack that, well, what's it mean to have all of this abundance available in a continuous manner? That's where the scale of things gets so staggering that it becomes hard to see even. And it's a scale that
small pieces of it can become obscured. And that's why it's, you know, I call it a dark miracle, because when you get these obscured places, the bad parts of human nature can crawl into them and exploit them.
Okay, we'll certainly get to the dark side here, but the bright side is what you call the shocking efficiency of stores and supply chains, which seems to get more efficient over time, or did, I should point out, up until we got to the pandemic and people started taking all that toilet paper. But just in general, how much less do we spend on food at this point in American history than our ancestors did?
Sure. I mean, first of all, forget our ancestors. Within the world right now, Americans spend the smallest amount of their income on food of anyone, I believe. We have the cheapest food supply chain for our income, and that's a radical shift from just our grandparents' grandparents. Turn of the century, they were spending about 40% of their income on food, and we spend less than 10% of our income on food. So if you can think of like an area of your life where you're suddenly freed up to spend an extra 30% of your income on whatever you want, I think that's sizable to what the impact of groceries has been over the century and the efficiency gains in both agriculture and in the supply chain. And it's momentous. It's really, in many ways, allowed for a middle class to grow. You know, in the book, I talk about Boris Yeltsin visiting a Randall's supermarket in Texas at the height of the Cold War, and he was just blown away by the idea that this exists. And I think he said something to the effect like he was nauseated by the idea that people back home would see this, because he knew it would mean revolution. He knew it would be an unacceptable situation.
All right, we're back to talk more about the American system of getting groceries to the store shelves and all the many parts and players involved. Benjamin Lohr wrote The Secret Life of Groceries. We're back on the Jefferson Exchange with Benjamin and you in a minute 10. There's kind of a quieter moment early in the book, Benjamin, and it's in talking with somebody who works at a poultry processing plant, where you get this sense of how we convert living things to food and food to products. But still in all, it seems like all the people involved in the chain have some idea on what the purpose is at the end.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think that moment with the purchasing plant, this was a man, I think, and maybe I'm misquoting the book, but he had supervised something like 750 million chickens execution at this this plant. He was very desensitized to this, and he got almost emotional talking about the moment that it goes from being this bird that is very much a living creature, dragged, you know, dangling on the line, bleeding out, to a food product where it suddenly is this gleaming globe of meat on a conveyor belt that is being cut up into little pieces to be shrink wrapped and put on a grocery shelf. And to me, that shift was very important, because I think grocery stores do a very analogous shift from not just living thing to food, but then from food, which we think of in terms of eating, but to product, which is, you know, not so different from staples, pencils, any other retail product, except for that it's perishable, and that if you don't get it out of your store quick, you will be dealing with a loss.
Okay. So the people at the end there are just there. That's their thing, is get the stuff out the door.
Well, that's definitely a big part of it. I mean, the supermarket in general is predicated on volume and turnover. That was kind of a big innovation that got the supermarket kicked off. If you think back to the early days, you know, pre-supermarket, which is maybe even hard to imagine, we had what was known as like a general store. And the general store existed, you know, like a hardware store with maybe some fruit and barrels and maybe some drugs, like opium or laudanum that they would sell in little vials. But it was, you know, all the food that they did sell was located behind a counter and sold in kind of anonymous bulk. And then gradually, over about a 70-year period, one, packaging got evolved to a place where instead of being sold in anonymous bulk, it was sold in individual packages, and individual packages needed labels, so they got a brand identity. And that caused people to want to choose and look at them and sift through them. And then people realized that if we sold these individual packages at volume, we could reduce price tremendously and create kind of a buying frenzy. And it really shifted consumption patterns. When the first supermarkets opened, first, all they did was list their prices. They were that the volume game was that much lower than the competition. So you'd have these page-long broadsheets in newspapers just listing prices, and it created a frenzy where people would drive 50 miles to a supermarket and kind of treat it like a circus because they'd never seen abundance like that.
Now, when you talk about, though, the how cardboard, it took about 70 years to get from cardboard to a supermarket. So let's talk about the Piggly Wiggly, because that was one of the first places where it really was a supermarket, right?
Yeah, and that, that transformation from general store to proto-supermarket, Clarence Saunders founded the Piggly Wiggly, and his big idea was, look, we are going to let the customer start touching these goods, and we're going to bring the goods to the customers. This is going to change things. One, rather than have lots of staff behind the counter who have to work, we only need staff to stock goods. So that's going to cut things down. And two, it's going to change the shopping experience because now people are going to be choosing between different goods. You're bringing something as a consumer to the game. And it's hard to think about from the modern perspective because that's the only way we've ever shopped. But for a long period, most goods existed only in anonymous bulk. You know, they were only barrels of crackers or jars of candy. And they didn't have the brand identity that they have now. So by putting that front and center, you can use different words to describe it, but maybe you call it empowering it. But he brought meaning to the shopping experience. All of a sudden, when you're sifting through different things and making choices, you can imbue those choices with meaning. So you're buying something for your husband becomes an act of love. You're buying a cheaper product becomes a demonstration of your virtue and your frugality rather than just replenishing your pantry.
Benjamin Lohr is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is The Secret Life of Groceries. So this is almost funny as you continue along the line of the history of supermarkets. A guy who worked for the Kroger company suggested that Kroger start making monstrous stores. And how did the folks in charge of Kroger at that time take to that suggestion?
Yeah, they said no. That was a big, so this is Michael Cullen, and he's generally, at least in my book, the guy who starts the supermarket off. He kind of comes up with this idea of taking Clarence Saunders' idea of letting customers touch the goods and letting them walk freely through the store and blowing it up to monster size. And that Kroger wanted no part of that at the time. So he said, I'm going to do it on my own. And he was wildly successful. It just was an idea that spread like wildfire. And, in 1930, when he founded it, there was exactly one store, his store. And in just a few years, almost every store was in this model.
Oh, yeah. There was a King Cullen not far from where I grew up on Long Island that we'd stop in every so often. So I recognize the name for sure. Now, another thing that I didn't stop to think about, I mean, we get through cardboard and people being able to select their own products. I didn't think about shopping carts. When did they come along?
For a long time that people wore, would carry baskets. And a grocer named Sylvan Goldman watches his customers struggling to put items in his basket, and he realizes, look, they'll put a lot more in if they don't have to carry these things around, biceps not being so big. So he invents the grocery cart. And the problem was, of course, you needed to make them foldable because otherwise you'd have to have a whole separate parking lot just for these carts that would be piled up. So he invents the foldable grocery cart. And people didn't like it at first. They didn't think they needed it. So he had to hire shills to go around the store, pushing grocery carts and mock filling them up with goods and then putting them back on the shelves to convince people that this was a good thing. And then, of course, they started doing it. And the grocery cart is now a a big thing.
All right, so you can cover a lot of ground in those stores. But so, all right, you were talking about King Cullen with the first monstrous store in 1930. How did the size of the square footage of that monstrous store compare with the size of supermarkets today?
So this was a store. When Michael Cullen opened up the King Cullen, first of all, like I said, circus. People were driving for miles around to get to this thing. Housewives would go into it, and they would declare they'd never seen anything so big, and it made them feel faint of heart that they were worried about getting lost into it. This was a 6,000-square-foot store. So that's a little bigger than a convenience store these days. And now we have stores that are 200,000 square feet. That's what Costco Superstore or a Walmart, Sam's Club is. So the idea that these were stores that people would feel faint in or be overwhelmed by seems pretty silly to our eyes, but it does show you just what a shift the grocery store was. Both, you can see it in the economics, but also just in mindset. Just to emphasize this point of just what a kind of profound shift it was when the first one of these opened in overseas, right? The grocery store is an extremely American invention, and they opened the first American size style supermarket in Rome in about 1956, and the Romans lost their minds. On ribbon cutting day, a woman started running up and down the aisles, shrieking, "This must be heaven," because they'd never seen that type of abundance of food before. And it's something that I think we've all kind of lost touch with. The grocery store has become this banal chore that we have to do. But it's really a revolutionary thing.
Truly. I mean, my father used to tell me stories about going into a little store in the Bronx when they still had pickle barrels, and he talked about the kids would throw chalk in there and spit in there and stuff. But, now you get your individually wrapped pickles in plastic and stuff, or certainly in jars. But, different times for sure. Benjamin Lohr is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the author of The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. You may have some supermarket observations or questions you'd like to share with us. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. By email, jx@jeffnet.org. Call from Helga in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. I want to bring up two things. One of them is you said we spend less on groceries now than we used to. Well, I happen to be involved in food and food waste, and let us point out that 50% of meals these days are eaten out. In other words, not at home, not cooked at home.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say we spend less for groceries, you've got to factor that in.
Okay.
The other question is waste from packaging. No. It's not only cardboard, it's plastic. It's indestructible things. So I hope you deal with that too.
Okay. Thanks, Helga. Appreciate that. So how much do you get into the waste end of things, Benjamin? Because we're churning up this much stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a huge issue. And there's a reason I call it the dark miracle of the American supermarket, because it is both miraculous in terms of what it gives us, but it comes at extreme cost. And food waste is an enormous issue, starting at the field in terms of the crops and goods that aren't deemed acceptable for grocery sale, so they just get left there to rot or that fall off along the chain and into the packaging. Which, again, it's, the other side of the coin when you get to individual items that are wrapped up for consumers, enable this consumption choice and, protection of the goods, which are all these reasons that people adopted packaging. It comes with enormous waste, and you we see the consequences of plastic in the oceans and in our landfills. So it's absolutely a critical side of the coin that I think that the book deals with.
Gotten well beyond
balancing out a lot of the negative.
Yeah, we've gone well beyond cardboard, that's for sure. And we pointed out the importance of cardboard to the modern grocery industry. Also ice, though. I mean, part of the history lesson comes back to ice. And 7-Eleven in particular came out of the ice industry. Explain the connection there.
Sure. It's one of these things we take completely for granted. But, 1880s, there was no ice machine in your fridge. There was no fridge. And so ice was this valuable product, actually, especially in the hotter regions. And so 7-Eleven came out of the Southland Corporation in Dallas, Texas, which gets extremely hot during the summer. And the Southland Corporation basically served to distribute ice. And that started, I believe, with like people would manually cut up lakes in the Northeast and then ship ice packaged in sawdust all over the world. But Southland was kind of a disruptor of this ice business, and they began using new technology to create artificial ice. And then they would sell it at retail docks, a little bit like a gas station, but of course this was pre-car, pre-combustion engine. And people would come up, buy their ice at the gas station, and one day a woman came after work and wondered aloud, like, God, it would be really nice if you could sell me some eggs and some food along with this ice. And it kind of a light bulb moment went off, and they started stocking minimal groceries at these ice docks, and that became the convenience store. It was available at later hours than the grocery store, and it offered just a few provisions that could be stored with the ice, and people could kind of do two-for-one shopping when they showed up there. And of course, the idea became enormously contagious, and within a few years, it developed into the 7-Eleven of today that just kind of spread out over the map.
So interestingly enough, though, 7-Eleven takes us into the story of Joe Colombe and Trader Joe's. I mean, so Joe was doing something, and Southland Corporation forced him out of his comfort zone and into this new realm. What happened?
That's right. So Joe Colombe is a, first of all, like I said, he's a fascinating guy. But he started in the grocery industry almost haphazardly. He got put in charge of a fleet of convenience stores in Southern California known as the Pronto Markets. And he didn't really know anything about grocery, but he knew that this convenience store was going to be big business. And he had modeled them off 7-Eleven, which at that point really only existed in the South. And then all of a sudden 7-Eleven shows up in Southern California and decides that they're going to expand there. And he realizes, oh, these people I've based my chain on, who are worth thousands of times what I'm worth, you know, as a convenience store owner, are going to come in and just trample me as a business owner. So he had to reinvent. And he did that by deciding he wasn't going to play the typical grocery game. And like I said from the beginning, like groceries is a game where you get bigger and bigger and you get a better volume and then you can get a better discount from that. And Joe kind of realized, one, I'm not going to get as big as 7-Eleven. And even if I did, I'll always be looking over my shoulder at somebody else because somebody else will be coming for that spot and trying to get bigger themselves. Just an unstable place to be. And so he went sideways. And that's really where Trader Joe's came from, this attempt to innovate out of the threat of 7-Eleven and create a chain that existed outside of the national homogeny of goods, the same old, same old. He thought, well, look, if I target a very specific demographic of consumers, and he zeroed in on people who are overeducated and underpaid for a variety of different reasons. He looked at, like, the GI Bill was coming into play for people coming back from Vietnam when he was forming his store, and he said, all these people who wouldn't ordinarily get college educations, they're now getting college educations, and I'm going to give them a grocery store that offers items that a college-educated person might want, which is, sounds odd, but this is the kind of, like, out-of-the-box thinking he was doing. And he also noted that the 747 was coming online, which was, of course, the first jumbo jet, and that would allow people to travel to new places. And he just thought that people were traveling to new places for the first time would come back and they'd want to eat food similar to what they experienced. And that was not available at, obviously, 7-Eleven in the 1950s, early 1960s, and it wasn't available at a grocery store. So he built this chain that pivoted away from the threat of 7-Eleven by creating kind of quirky options, and that became the 7-Eleven. That became the Trader Joe's, the blueprint that really allowed Trader Joe's to develop.
We're going to have to stop in about a minute, but I wanted to get started on the AAA egg story. This is a good hint at Joe Colombe's thinking.
Yeah, so this was a very formative moment for him. He's operating Pronto Markets, and an egg salesman comes in, and he says, Joe, I can sell you these AAA jumbo eggs for cheaper than I can sell you the large AA eggs. And he says, well, that doesn't make any sense. There's a better product for less money. And the guy says, yeah, the reason is they're not continuously offered goods. They're discontinuous goods. It takes a really big bird to create a AAA egg, and those big birds tend to be the older females who die off in the summer heats because they're old.
Okay, and so we'll hold the story there at dead
we'll
birds. Sorry,
yeah. In suspense.
The book is called The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. It's by Benjamin Lohr. He'll finish the story about the large birds and the AAA eggs when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. So back to Trader Joe's, Joe Colombe, and the story of the AAA eggs, a discontinuous good because it won't always be available.
Yes, so these big birds laying the big eggs die, and that means you can't get their eggs year-round. And so the managers at the local Safeway, the other competing grocery chains, didn't want them. They didn't want to offer a product that would only be around seasonally. It didn't fit with their mindset of what a grocery store was. So Joe said, well, I'll take them. I'll sell a better product for cheaper money. And it kind of opened up this window in his mind that there were probably lots of discontinuous items. There were lots of opportunities for a better product that was cheaper, but wasn't necessarily available. And if he could only zero in on the supply chain and learn more about where food came from, he could find and exploit those kind of loopholes. And he did just that.
So it's not about just discounting. It's about finding stuff that he thinks people will want, which has some level of business acumen, or at least knowing the desires of his audience pretty amazingly well. So measured by sales per square foot, how does Trader Joe's measure up against the big chains?
Oh yeah, I mean, so one, I think what you were saying about business acumen and knowing the supply chain. He's 100% right. And I just want to emphasize it. I think Joe would say his most important decision was that he decided to pay his employees and in particular his buyers more than anyone else. So in the industry, so he had the highest paid and what he would call the smartest buyers that were applying themselves to studying supply chains. And he didn't want them to just act as replenishers who were just going and kind of filling out order boxes. He wanted them to use that intelligence to get the best possible goods. and to circle back around to your actual question, it paid off tremendously. I mean, Trader Joe's is the highest sales per square foot by a wide margin in the grocery industry, basically doubling Whole Foods in terms of sales per square foot, which is Whole Foods being the number two. So it's like it's a full, twice as sharp when it comes to sales per square foot as Whole Foods.
Let's take some calls. Ann and Eugene, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Benjamin Lohr.
Thank you. So I grew up in and around St. Joseph, Missouri, which is used to have a big slaughterhouse, and it still has packing houses. And in the 50s and 60s, probably before that, working in the packing house was a good job. It was a union job. You got good wages. And even though it was hard, dirty work, there was a good reward for it. So to get to the dark side, now the people who harvest and process our food, they're non-union. They're treated like slaves. And so that's where a lot of this lower price comes into, because the people that are doing the work are getting the shaft. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ann. Appreciate that. So, yeah, there is the dark side of this, and a lot of people involved in the process not getting the kind of money that Trader Joe's paid to his buyers.
Yes. And that's an amen from me. That is 100% accurate. And the labor... You wouldn't know necessarily from what we've talked about so far, but a great portion of this book goes into those effects on labor, because there's one thing that hasn't changed is actually the quality of our food has gone up, and our food safety standards has gone up. So everything is increasing where are these savings coming from? Volume gets you somewhere, but all too often the way that savings come, and especially in a globalized world, is through cuts to labor. And so it can be very deceptive for a consumer. I talked to a supply chain expert in the seafood industry, and she said if you pick up an everyday seafood product you grew up with, like a can of tuna, it looks exactly the same as when you're a kid or when your parents were kids, but the way it's processed today is completely different. And I think that, you know, what you said about slaughterhouses is true for the trucking industry. In the 70s, the trucking industry was blue collar but unionized and middle class, the upper middle class job. Now it is a place that's rife with actual debt peonage and very low wages. It's true for retail workers. You know, we all worked, or not all, but I happen to have worked a number of like minimum wage jobs when I was in high school and in college. And I have memories of those jobs. The situation there has deteriorated quite a bit from even when I was in college. And of course, overseas, where you get even further from labor protection in the U.S. and kind of out of sight, out of mind, the costs that the quote unquote efficiency gains in labor often come in extremely dehumanizing ways. And the book, I think, explores that.
It does indeed. Yeah, your time spent with the trucker in particular, the fact that they end up in a lease agreement for a truck they can never pay off, and that it'll probably get repossessed from them at some point. I mean, the way I wrote the question was, yikes, truckers get screwed. They really do. I mean, so did you get to a macro view at some point, Benjamin, about some sense of what would happen if wages went up, perhaps to a family level, and if grocery prices would have to just edge up a bit with them, or if they'd take off too?
Yeah, I think it's an unexplored question. We have an economic policy in this country that basically does everything in favor of the consumer and consumption and fights for lowest price. And there are good reasons for that, and we can all vocalize that because we're all consumers and we all benefit that. But at the same time as we're all consumers, we're also all laborers. And so it's coming out of the back end, and especially as class and wealth inequity grows, there's a disconnect, I think, between the people who are making the policy and the people who are actually working in these jobs. To answer your question specifically, did I get to a macro view? No, I think in many ways it's an open question as to whether treating people with dignity around the world, and that's not just a U.S. thing at all, perhaps that's obvious, but whether that would break the system. And whether that would cause big disruptions. It's certainly, there's a lot of grocery buyers who think it would. Otherwise, I think you would see quicker change in this. But it will take a shift, and I get into this in the book, beyond merely shopping decisions. It will take fundamental shifts in strengthening unions, creating wage floors, alleviating poverty, and probably restructuring the way we relate to labor and changing people from being just laborers to actual shareholders in a company, because it's just too easy to outsource labor and to see it as a cost to be cut in a kind of a race to the bottom if people aren't actually connected to the output of that. So these are really big questions that I wish I had a pithy answer for, but it gets deep.
Well, yeah, but as you point out, with the things that you're talking about as being necessary, like unions and regulation and minimum wage floors, we have not been very good in keeping those things up in recent years. They have all tended to lay fallow for a while. Union membership down, minimum wage has not increased at the federal level in quite some time, and on we go. Let me
go ahead. I just want to say, those are policy decisions. Like, it is not an accident that the union movement has been gutted in this country. There is a concerted effort to do that. And similarly with labor rights, these things are not accidental. It comes from treating the consumer like that consumer is a god, and anything that benefits the consumer is good for America. And you can see why that makes sense. Yeah, our groceries are a lot cheaper. But since we're also laborers at the same time as we're consumers, it creates this kind of schism or this split personality disorder in terms of us as a country. And, there's a lot of it just completely indecent, what I would call indecent behavior going on in terms of how we treat laborers.
It's kind of the opposite of Henry Ford, isn't it? Where Henry Ford said, I have to pay people well enough to buy my cars. I have to make my groceries cheap enough so that my employees can afford them.
That's right. And, I was working at this Whole Foods fish market for this book, and people would ask us how to prepare the food, and it was just this ongoing joke because we were selling $29 per pound king salmon, and nobody who was making $11 per hour there was taking that home to eat and cook. And we would have a few recipes that our supervisor had maybe told us, but the conversational attitude that the customers would come up and be like, oh, how would you cook this? It's like, no, that era of a fishmonger is not present in this model.
Right. And I can still smell the smells that you relate from working at the fish section at Whole Foods. It was quite vivid. Yeah. Let's take another call from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Benjamin Lohr.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I got a little story for you that'll put things in perspective. When I was teaching high school years ago, we had Russian students come here over here finally, and the Sister City program here in town took them to Fred Meyer, and they were, one of the Russian kids thought that we just gathered up all the food in Grants Pass and stuck it in the toilet. All the other stores are empty. And then another Russian kid thought you're going to have to call the police on the riot when the food, and then they saw the pet food aisle. And one of them, it's just, we have, it's amazing our system that there's always stuff there. There's never a shortage. Anyway, I want your comment on that, because you also mentioned that in Germany, when I was in Germany, I never saw a big supermarket. So anyway.
All right. Thanks, John. Appreciate that.
No, I really appreciate that, because it drives it home, and it's something that I think you can't tell the story if you leave that part out. And I very much did not want to tell a book write a book that was only harping on the miseries in the industry, because it's an inaccurate picture of what we've created. It might be a monster, but it is a monster that is never. There's never been anything like it before in the history of humanity. It's a truly miraculous thing. And the only way that we can begin to reform it, I think, is by grappling with all of its enormous positive aspects.
So we have just enough time to get a word in here about Whole Foods. And Errol Schweitzer in particular pointed out who pays when you just try to be the cheapest. What was his perspective on that?
Sure. This was the former head of grocery at Whole Foods National. And Earl, essentially, if it's going to come out of your producers and your labor, if you're going to be caught in a race to the bottom, if you're just trying to be the cheapest. Whole Foods really, for most of its existence, was not that. They really nurtured young entrepreneurs. They certainly walked the walk better than anyone else in the industry. And I can't totally comment on where the store is right now. I'm not connected enough to do so. But I do know that they made kind of a strategic decision pre-Amazon to centralize their buying structures and really concentrate more on getting to a lower price, partly due to Wall Street pressures and that kind of whole paycheck mentality. And certainly when you do that, it comes out of your employees and it comes out of their producers.
Well, and this is the interesting thing about them. And this is really triggered by shareholders then. They had activist shareholders who said, this company needs more value. And the way to do that is to drive the prices down.
That's right. That's right. And I think, if there was a big meta story to this book, it's the way that good intentions and people actually acting out of not just their own self-interest, it's not greed, but they're actually trying to serve other people, but the way that acts of service to other people can lead us to really dark places, because it turns out that people want to be served in ways that are contradictory, chaotic, and potentially unsustainable.
Is there any chain you feel like is able to deliver on a good balance of price versus quality and include equity in the transaction as well?
You know, I don't want to be playing favorites. I think there's a lot of goodwill in the industry, and people are working really hard to reform these things. There are the structural issues that exist outside the industry that we've touched on that makes all the good intentions and the efforts in the world extremely difficult to act on.
The book is called The Secret Life of Groceries, The Dark Miracle of the American Supermarket. Benjamin Lohr put 5 years into the book to bring it to us. Benjamin, thank you for the book and for joining us on The Exchange.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a total pleasure.
All right, good to have you. That'll do it for today's Exchange. We're online at jeffexchange.org, also on social media, Twitter and Facebook. The Exchange is produced by John Baxter and Angela Decker of JPR News. Student assistant Randy Babbitt's at the controls. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Take care of yourself. Stay safe. We'll talk again soon.